Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, do you struggle with dieting and weight loss? If so, how much do you know about fat? Unhappy with a lifetime of weight issues, author Sylvia Tara sought to find a solution. She explains what she discovered in her new book, The Secret Life of Fat, the science behind the body's least understood organ and what it means for you.
Because fat is so important and a number of different body parts depend on it, nature has ways to protect it. And if you don't really understand what they are, you just end up with weight gain, chronic weight gain every time you lose it.
Tara spoke with KUOW's Ruby DeLuna at Town Hall Seattle on January 9th. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the full presentation on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Town Hall's Katie Sewell introduces Sylvia Tara and Ruby DeLuna.
Sylvia Tara is a biochemist and science writer. She holds a PhD from the University of California, San Diego, and an MBA from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. During her professional life, she's worked as a healthcare management consultant and with some of the largest biotech companies. She joins us tonight to discuss her book, The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means to You. And Sylvia is joined in conversation tonight with KUOW's Ruby DeLuna. Ruby is a features reporter at KUOW, where she's worked since 1994, and she regularly covers healthcare issues and immigration. Welcome to the stage, Sylvia Tara and Ruby DeLuna.
Thanks, Katie, and thank you to all. Welcome to Town Hall, and thank you to Sylvia for joining us. I'm looking forward to this conversation, and as I was preparing for this, I was thinking about society's view of fat. I was wondering, you know, how did fat get a bad rap? Because there was a time when fat was considered beautiful. In some cultures, it was even considered a sign of prosperity. But at some point, fat became the bad guy. Studies have shown that it leads to heart disease, diabetes, and other health problems. And health issues aside, fat was associated with a character defect. You know, it was a sign of laziness or lack of self-control. So today we're spending time and money to fight fat. We're trying to shed it, hide it, or shape it with Spanx. So, but as more information comes out about fat, we're beginning to see that it's not quite black and white. And so I'm looking forward to exploring this with Sylvia Tara. But before we talk about your findings, Sylvia, can you tell us why you decided to research fat?
Sure. Can everyone hear me okay, first of all? It's okay? Okay, good. Yeah, no, I decided to write this book and do this research because my whole life I've just gained weight so easily, much easier than people around me. I've seen other people eat more, exercise less, and stay perfectly thin, and I could never do that. And I went on a number of diets. I worked with personal trainers. You know, I felt like I did everything, and I'd lose some weight, and it would creep back, and sometimes I could even gain weight depending on the diet, oddly, and it was a shock to many trainers as well. And I finally got really sick of all of this. I was about to go on another diet, and I said, forget it. I'm not going on one more diet until I understand everything there is to know about fat, particularly my fat, my very stubborn fat that will not leave me. And so I'm a biochemist by training, and I thought if anyone can understand fat, I can, right? And so I spent 5 years really just digging through the literature. I pulled out over 1,000 scientific articles. I spoke to probably dozens, probably around 50 researchers around the world about their cutting-edge research on fat. And what I was finding out was just so astounding. It was so surprising. I thought, I have to write this in a book. I have to tell the story of fat and just share it with everybody. And The Secret Life of Fat is that book.
And it's aptly named, too.
Yes.
Well, okay, so first of all, people understand fat as this storage of energy. Yeah. That's our basic understanding, but it's really much more complex than that. And in your book, you even said it's an organ. Yeah. Can you explain?
Yeah, sure. So fat molecules themselves, fatty acids, are a source of energy. They go through a degradative process and they release energy that our bodies use. But fat is tissue collectively around your body, right? It actually serves as an organ. It's not unlike skin. So if you take a piece of skin, it's a piece of tissue. But skin overall in totality is an organ, and fat is the same way. So although fat can be used as energy, it also releases a number of hormones that our body depends on, really vastly depends on. One of those is leptin, and leptin actually has direct control on our appetite and our metabolism. So when we lose fat, we lose some leptin, and our appetite gets bigger, our metabolism goes down. It has all these ways to fight for its own survival, if you will, by controlling our appetite and metabolism. But in a lot of organs, other organs in our body depend on it too. Our bones are highly dependent on fat. Weight is a trigger for strong bones. Reproductive systems, particularly in women, really impacted by fat. 3 pounds can turn it on or off, right? So if you get below a threshold, you can actually turn off menstrual cycles and other things. Brain size is linked to fat. And so, you know, because fat is so important and a number of different body parts depend on it, nature has ways to protect it. And if you don't really understand what they are, you just end up with weight gain, chronic weight gain every time you lose it.
Hmm. So it's as if it has a mind of its own.
Yeah, fat's a person.
Well, no, and I think what
it's a person, and you have to really understand its personality, what it's up to, you know, what tricks it has up its sleeve, if you really want to, you know, manage your fat. And I think that's kind of how I saw it. Like, I saw it just, it was a war of wills, if you will. You know, fat wanted to stay on, and I wanted it to leave, and I had to get really clever, and I had to really, really persist. It was like a very spoiled, rotten child that I had to really put in its place. And I think if you could understand all that it's really doing in your body, and it's doing so much more than storing energy, and you have to really understand how your whole body coordinates to keep your fat on. It does take a lot more persistence in the end, a lot more hard work. I think people are looking for very quick solutions, and they sell. I mean, you can go to any bookstore, and you'll see all the diet books out there, and it's easy. You should never be hungry. You can eat whatever you like, and yet somehow your fat will work, and yet we have more obese people than ever in the country. So clearly those gimmicks aren't really working. And I think there's no real substitute for just understanding fat at a scientific level and being willing to do the work and be as determined as you need to be to control it.
Well, I kind of like how you write about fat. It says it's a character. Yeah. Fat is a character in this book, and it's almost like a frenemy. You know, that you need some fat, but yeah. It also, if you have too much of it, it really works against you.
That's right. So there's different kinds of fat in our body, too, and that's what's important to know. So we have subcutaneous fat, and that's the fat that's right underneath your skin, you know, your legs, your buttock area, arms. And then there's also visceral fat. And that's fat that's underneath the stomach wall, right? And that can get very crowded, and when it does, it gets inflamed. It actually recruits the immune system into it, and that interferes with insulin signaling. And so when you do that, then you have all these triglycerides and sugars hanging around your blood. You're not responding to insulin as well. And that's the kind of fat that is correlated with diabetes and heart disease. And that's the fat to really watch. That's all the rap that you hear about fat being so dangerous. It's very much around that. You know, there's brown fat, too, and that's the type of fat that actually burns energy for heat. So instead of hoarding, which white fat does, it actually, its main function is for heat and to burn energy. And then there's beige fat, which is newly discovered fat. And that's fat that is capable of turning brown upon exercise or cold exposure. And then we have fat in our brains. I mean, our myelin, the sheath around the axon part of the neuron, that's very much made 85% fat, right? And fat's in every one of our cells around the lipid bilayer, so it has a lot of different functions in our body. And that's what you have to be aware of. There's you can be fat but fit, right? And some people are. They are heavy, but they store it in safer deposits. So subcutaneous fat around your hips, you know, your arms, anything that's right under your skin is actually, it's best to not have too much fat, but if you're going to have it, that's the place to have it. I talk about the case of sumo wrestlers, which is a curious case of fit but fat. And so sumo wrestlers, they eat 5,000 to 7,000 calories a day, you know, usually non-processed food, but they eat a lot, an awful lot, but they exercise 6 to 7 hours a day.
So fat has another kind of trick up its sleeve, is that it actually releases a hormone called adiponectin. And adiponectin actually helps keep us healthy. It helps clear triglycerides, fats, out of the blood and bring it into subcutaneous fat tissue where it belongs, right? And it actually helps reduce visceral fat. Mm-hmm. And exercise promotes the release of adiponectin. So these sumo wrestlers are gorging themselves, they're eating a lot, but they're exercising a lot, and they're actually releasing quite a bit of adiponectin. And they have low visceral fat. So all that fat in their belly is actually underneath the skin, less underneath the stomach wall. And they're actually quite metabolically healthy. When they come off their exercise regime and they go back to normal living when they're retired, they actually become unhealthy very quickly because they're not exercising as much and then they're eating regular food. They're not staying with the non-processed type. So, you know, best to not look like a sumo wrestler, really. But if you're going to gain weight, you know, the key is to really keep it away from your belly as much as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. So remind us again, what makes visceral fat not healthy? And is it the same? I know I've heard doctors talk about fatty liver. Is that similar to that concept of, you know, the fat being really close to the organ?
Yeah, more or less. So visceral fat, it sends out a distress signal when the fat cells get really crowded. So it will signal, and when it does that, you know, through cytokines and other types of chemical messaging, the body sends immune system cells, so macrophages, TNF-alpha, different things will come into your fat. So it's not unlike when you get a cut, your body is sensing something's wrong, there's danger here. You know, your visceral fat can send out a similar signal to recruit immune cells to it. And when that happens, it interferes with the sensitivity to insulin. And if you're not sensitive to insulin, then your fats and sugars are floating around. Your cells are not internalizing it. So insulin from the pancreas normally is a signal to your cells to internalize fats and sugars from your blood, internalize them into cells, keep your blood fairly clean. And when you're not responding to it, that's not happening. They're floating around. They're depositing where they shouldn't deposit. So you get sometimes in your liver, you'll get fat deposited in your liver. You'll get it in your heart. You'll get it in other places where it really shouldn't be. And that's when it becomes quite unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the other things that you write about in the book is that fat is key for reproductive functions. Has that always been a known thing?
No, that's a great story. I tell the story of Rose Frisch, who was a researcher at Harvard Public Health, and she actually came upon this. She was doing a different type of research. She was looking at what the calorie needs are for the world's population, and she was looking at populations in Pakistan, and she noticed that girls in poorer neighborhoods, they menstruated later, years later, than girls from more well-to-do neighborhoods. And she couldn't figure out why this was. And you know, finally, after years of looking at this, she determined it was the amount of fat they had. So it wasn't bone, it wasn't age, it wasn't, you know, anything else about them, it wasn't height. It was fat was linked to menstruation and going through puberty. And you know, she actually was ignored for quite a long time. People just thought this wasn't important. They thought it was ridiculous. They thought she wasn't, you know, the right type of scientist to be saying this. And she just kept on. And she faced quite a bit of sexism at Harvard too. They would ask her to take notes for the male sciences. Like, they just totally dismissed all of this. And finally, she started getting some traction when reproductive specialists would call her. So OBGYNs would call her and say, you know, I read something about your research, and I have to tell you, I'm experiencing this. So when some women come in and they're very low weight, like ballerinas or athletes, they're not menstruating. So she started getting traction finally. And what she did find out is that there's a minimum level of body fat that girls need in order to undergo puberty. Really, and so it's around around 17 to 22% in there. And if you don't have that amount, you either delay puberty, you don't go through it, or if you're an athlete or a ballerina, you've started it, but now you're exercising and getting your fat off, you'll stop menstruating, or you'll have it sporadically. And in fact, doctors I talk to in Southern California, you know, where I live, eating disorders are quite high in that area, and they'll say the same thing, that they have to try to coax some of these women to get more fat on in order to reproduce, or they have to artificially induce it with exogenous hormones. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this, to me, that was an illustration of how fat serves a role.
Yeah.
It helps regulate hormones. In a way, it tells the body, hey, you know, you're ready now to conceive, or the condition is right,
yeah,
you know, to have kids, in essence.
It's a signal of what your environment is, in a way, right? So if your environment's unhealthy, there's not food, there's not enough fat, well, then you can't be bringing somebody into the world just yet. That's how I see it, anyway. It seems like a signal to the body that all is right in the world, mm-hmm. and we're ready to undergo puberty and reproduce. And, you know, it's the leptin it produces, but also estrogen. It's a big producer of estrogen as well. And actually, as women go through menopause, they start to depend on fat more for that source of estrogen. And it's at least hypothesized that might be one reason why it gets harder to lose in women later, is because it actually serves a role as a supplier of estrogen.
Yeah. Well, speaking of hormones, so there seems to be a gender difference. I mean, this is now confirmed. There's a gender difference when it comes to fat. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I had to do this research because I am married to somebody, you know, a man who just eats ice cream every day, and he still fits into the genes he did in college, and I actually got so frustrated at watching this, and I said, I'm going to figure out why you can do that. And I think every woman in the world has been frustrated at this at some point, and it turns out women are right as usual. We gain weight easier than men. So actually, from the time of birth, really, girl babies have more fat than boy babies do, and I think it actually happens even before in utero, that we're just accumulating more fat. And there's a number of reasons for it. One is nutrient partitioning. So as you eat, your body will divert, you know, nutrients into different tissues. And there's like a set amount that will go into fat. And women partition more of the nutrients into fat than men do, which is probably why from the time they're born, they're actually got a little bit more fat on them. The other thing is that we actually utilize fat more. And this was surprising to me, that at a period of fast, like our overnight fast, or after we're depleted from exercise and we're, you know, really in a fasted state, our bodies will reach for fat as a source of energy more than men will. Men will actually use protein and glycogen more, which is a carbohydrate store. And you would think this is great news that we're actually using fat. But then we're actually very good at storing it away right after that need is met. So if you exercise 1 hour a day, that's great. You're burning some fat there. But for the other 23 hours, you're actually storing more fat into your tissue, 2 to 3 times more per unit of tissue than men are. So we're very efficient fat storers. Right? That makes sense. It sounds like a terrible thing, but in a way, it keeps women healthier, right? We tend to have a little bit less metabolic disease, a little bit cleaner. We don't have all the metabolic markers that men do. Men tend to get more visceral fat, and it takes women longer, like older in years, before they'll get that. So there's some benefit for being a little bit fatter. You know, a third part is that we actually we get hungrier after exercise than men do. And there's an interesting experiment I talk about in The Secret Life of Fat where there's another hormone called ghrelin that is released from the stomach, and it's a hunger hormone. It makes you hungry. So after women use up, say, a very intense exercise where they do about 600 calories, they'll burn off. We have 33% more ghrelin release than men do. So we have, you know, feasibly a little bit more hunger. But even after we eat, we still have 25% more, right? Mm-hmm. So we compensate. And they show this with an experience where they have women go to a buffet and they'll eat after they work out. And mm-hmm. women tend to just, they'll overcompensate at that time. So not only do we store our fat away, right, very efficiently, but we'll eat more too. I think nature wants us to be just a little bit fatter than men, so... I love your fat.
So does that mean then that if we're trying to replenish whatever energy that we had used up, to do so less enthusiastically,
I think it's pacing yourself, really. Oh. You know, stop a little bit earlier if you can. Some of that urge does go away. Certainly eating proteins will help so that you're not going to eat all carbs that are going to be deposited, you know, later as fat or more fibrous foods. I mean, that's all things to think about. Or just eat slower, right? Just don't do it as quickly. But, you know, it is interesting because it helped explain some of my issues. I worked with male personal trainers trying really hard to get my fat off, and I think they always couldn't understand what was wrong, like why it wasn't working. And they'd say, well, you just cut out sugar and you'll be fine. And that, you know, it was much harder. And, of course, these guys were six-pack abs and muscle people and... You know, so I think you have to be wary. There's not one diet that works for everyone, and depending on who you're working with or who's written the diet book that you're reading now, you know, it might not be for you. There's just so many differences among people. Gender's one, but
You know, genetics is another thing I write about. Even bacteria and viruses have a role. Age has a role. Our hormone levels, and just depending on where you are, if you're like a 50-year-old woman, you can't diet the same as a 25-year-old man. It's going to be a very different experience. I do think the more people understand what goes into fatness, what's making you more fat than someone else, it helps you be patient, perhaps less gullible towards all these different diet books and plans out there, and a little bit more in control. I do think knowledge is power in this if you understand really what goes into your fat.
You also wrote that there's a virus or virus that causes obesity.
Yeah.
That to me almost sounded like a page from The X-Files. So, yeah, so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's always shocking to people. And it's been known to happen in animals for quite some time. Canine distemper virus was shown to cause fatness in mice in, I think, 1982. Rouse-associated virus causes fatness in chickens, right? And that's been known about since the 80s. But when you tell people that it happens in humans, too, they get very alarmed at this, and there's a lot of skepticism. But I do tell the story of a scientist named Nikhil Durander, who actually had a very fateful, interesting life that I lay out in the book. And he had noticed that in India, where he was from, that there was an SMAM1 virus that was actually hurting the poultry industry, and it was killing off chickens. But interesting, when they actually dissected these chickens to try to figure out what's wrong, they noticed they were getting fatter. And he was really surprised at this, because usually a virus will make you sicker and thinner, and then you die. But these chickens were actually getting abdominal fat with this virus. And he became intrigued with this, and he started looking at people who've carried the SMAM1 virus in India. And he noticed they had a much higher incidence of obesity than people who haven't carried this virus. So he was very, just intrigued by this, and he decided he gave up his thriving obesity practice. I think he had 3 obesity clinics, and he decided he's going to give up everything, and he's going to dedicate his life to understanding this. And then he packs up his suitcase for himself and his wife and 2 kids, one kid actually, and he goes to the U.S., and he thought, okay, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to discover this. And through so many twists and turns, he couldn't get a job. He ended up looking at sunflowers for 2 years. He was about to go back to India, and then finally somebody hired him to look at this virus, Richard Atkinson at University of Wisconsin. And he's all excited. He gets to study the virus, but then he can't bring the virus, SMAM1, into the U.S. The Department of Agriculture won't allow it, so he's back at square one. And miraculously, he finds a virus upon the first, picking that has the same qualities as this SMAM1 virus in India, and that is the AD36 virus. And AD36 actually does increase fatness in humans. And the way it works is that it increases the absorption of glucose from the blood into cells. It increases the amount of fat molecules we make and increases the number of fat cells. So really, the fat cells you have are getting bigger, and you're creating more of them. And all the while he's discovering this and learning about it, I pair this with a patient named Randy, who, unbeknownst to him, was infected with AD36. He thinks it was from a farm. He grew up on a chicken farm, and he links it to this time where he got scratched by a rooster. And he started becoming just, hungrier, started noticing weight gain, and he really struggled with fat for decades, to the point that he was 350 pounds and, in his 40s, and he was going through a number of different diet programs and just struggling. And finally, his doctor recommends this program at University of Wisconsin, because it's an educational program. He thinks it's going to help him control his fat. That's where he meets Nikhil Durander, the person who has studied AD36, and he gets tested for AD36 and learns he's positive for it. And his fat starts to make sense to him finally. This program, he says, it wasn't blame heavy. They didn't blame you for where you gotten. It was more of, here's fat, here's how leptin works, here's how set point works. You have this AD36 virus, this is how it works. And so he becomes just very disciplined, very regimented about his diet. I think he felt empowered at that point to really take it on. He felt like he found the right team that didn't put a lot of guilt on him. They educated him. They helped him along the way. They would see him twice a week. It was a very, frequently, they visited with patients very frequently. And he did learn he has to eat less. So having this virus doesn't mean you have to be fat or have to be obese. It does mean you have to work harder at being thin. And Randy calls himself not part of the eating world. He's got the world separated into the eating world and the not eating world. And he's 63 now, I think, and he's about 6'1". He eats about 1,200 to 1,500 calories a day, and he works out regularly. And he's really thin. He's in excellent shape, better than he ever has been. But it's just more care, more effort for him versus someone who might not have these issues.
I could only imagine having that acknowledged meant something for him that, I'm not crazy that these series of events happened after that incident with the rooster.
Yeah, and I think this is where, you know, knowledge is power. So, you know, he probably thought, he did think that he was failing on diets, that something was wrong. I think we all feel that way. When we have diets that don't work, it's, I'm doing something wrong, you know, or it's just me. And because fat is such a judgment, you feel like you're bad, like you're just not doing this right, you're not trying hard enough. And really for him, just knowing it, I think helped set him in the right direction where he felt like he knew what to do now. And so I think this can be depressing sometimes. You know, I've heard that you know, some of the findings I have in my book about how stubborn fat is, people just feel depressed. And I actually had the opposite reaction. When I started learning all this about fat, I had the same reaction as Randy, I suppose, where I felt like, now I get it. Now I get why I gain weight so easy. Now I know what to do. And so, you know, my personal trainer is telling me to eat 1,500 to 1,600 calories a day, or, you know, telling me I'm starving if I don't eat enough. I know it's not true for me. Right, and that this is what people I think have to understand is that every biology, every person is different, and just depending on where you are, what you've got for your genes, what age you are, you have to really fine tune a diet to you. And hopefully, you know, the research I do helps people feel like they're not crazy, right? They can start to diagnose themselves a little bit more and understand what it is about them that might be resisting weight loss.
And the other aspect to that was about your findings that fascinated me was this idea that fat could possibly be a form of treatment, that it contains stem cells. Right. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, so fat actually, it's loaded with stem cells. So stem cells come from your bone marrow, they migrate, and it actually houses a number of stem cells. And so, you know, the future of fat might be as a therapeutic, oddly enough. All that liposuction we get stored in jars might actually be useful for something. So, you know, stem cells are these pluripotent cells in our body, and they can morph into different things. They release different types of, you know, chemicals and, you know, cytokines from them. And they have these healing powers, and we know this. We've heard about embryonic research or, you know, stem cells having all this potential. And it might turn out that fat can replace some of that. And so what it's been used for so far, you know, one, interestingly, on wrinkles. People in clinics are injecting it into faces, and it makes the skin a little bit smoother. But also, I think Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, used it in his back. He had a back injury. He had stem cells from fat injected, and he healed, you know, quickly, very happy with the result. And, you know, for wounds, for skin, too, using fat-derived stem cells for treatment, and even skull fractures. I think I read about one research where they used it in a fracture, and so it helps heal. It has, you know, the future of fat might be very different from how we think of it now. Yeah.
So it could be more treasured then.
Yeah. Maybe you could sell your fat. I don't know. I can get to that point.
Commodity. And so were there any more findings or any more research in that area since your book was published, anything more?
Yeah, well, there's interesting ways people are looking at how people can lose weight, because that's the real demand, I guess. So, you know, we talked about brown fat and that it burns calories, and one thing that's being looked at is injecting brown fat into white fat. So apparently there's someone in Australia who's managed to grow brown fat in a dish, take it out of people, grow it, expand the cells, and then inject it back in. And it actually does. It burns calories, and they're able to eat a little bit more than they were before with more brown fat. I mean, there's more natural ways to create brown fat. Cold exposure is another way our body converts some of that fat
to brown.
So what's
the distinction for some folks who may not know the distinction between white fat and brown fat? Is it like good fat and bad fat?
Well, brown fat, you know, as I said earlier, burns energy. So, you know, it's a type of fat in our body that actually produces heat. So our white fat will store a lot of calories. That's what it for. It hoards energy. But brown fat has a lot of mitochondria in it, and it produces a lot of heat. So we have it around our clavicle region, around our heart and our spine, key areas in our body. Babies have more of it proportionately than adults do. And so a number like on mice, different animal studies where they're trying to actually inject brown fat more into it in the hopes that it helps people burn off, you know, more calories and that they can lose weight.
But as we age, do we lose the brown fat, or does it have to do with lifestyle or a combination of other factors.
You lose it from the time you're a baby to adult. I don't know that it declines more mm-hmm. as we age further. You're given, it's a set amount, and things that actually help propagate brown fat are, you know, cold, being in cold. Exercise, interestingly, will help. So the beige fat we talked about that has the potential to turn into brown, it turns into brown upon exercise. There's a hormone called irisin when you exercise that will turn beige fat brown. So, you know, exercise is good for all kinds of things, and I write about this in the book, too. One is the adiponectin we talked about with sumo wrestlers. That's really good. It also helps promote growth hormone and testosterone, which are natural fat burners, and those decline with age. Some of the fat distribution we see as we age, we get fatter overall. Changes, I think women get more fat in their hips and their lower abdomen and their thighs. Men will get more of it on the belly. All of that has to do with how our hormones are declining with age. And so really, fat's almost a force of nature as we age. I talk about one research done by Paul Williams. He studied 5,000 male runners. And he noticed that no matter how much they were running 10 miles a week, 20 miles a week, they were getting fatter with age. So even really fit, you know, runners were getting fatter. And he determined that the way they could offset this was by increasing their weekly run by 1.4 miles every year. So if a runner was running, you know, 10 miles or, you know, or so, or 20 miles, say, at the age of 30, 20 miles a week, by the time they were 40, they had to be running 34 miles a week, so 1.4 mile every year. And that way they could fit into the same clothing they did 10 years ago. So really, you know, with age, you know, it's not that you're doing something wrong or you're a glutton or you know, something's amiss. It's just that we're prone to get a little bit more fat with age. And I also write about the obesity paradox where they're finding fat might even be protective with old age, where, you know, sometimes in disease or trauma, people who actually have a little bit more fat, they do better. They have a lower risk of death than people who are underweight or even normal weight. So some of the diseases fat is thought to cause, like diabetes and heart disease, you know, when people are actually, they have a heart attack or they're actually very sick from it, the heavier ones, oddly, are doing better. It could have to do with a lot of things. Maybe they have less visceral fat, more subcutaneous fat. They might be in better shape overall, but nonetheless, they're noticing they have a little bit more fat. And so fat with age might not be horrible. I think, you know, around the visceral area, it still needs to be controlled. But, you know, then there's exercise and other things we can do to try to keep it in check with age.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you pointed out about fat, one of the characteristics is that when it senses that it's being, you're trying to get rid of it, it fights back, that it even sends out messages as if, you know, to kind of protect itself.
Right.
Right?
Right. Yeah, so we talked about leptin a bit. Mm-hmm. So our fat releases leptin, and leptin has control on our appetite. It has control of metabolism. So you normally, when we're, you know, we have sufficient fat, all's fine. We're overall pretty satiated, and our metabolism is good. When we lose fat, we lose leptin, and you become somewhat leptin deficient. And when that happens, your appetite will go through the roof. And they notice that people who have lost 10% of their weight, they're hungrier after a meal than they were before they lost that weight. So even though they've eaten the same amount of calories as before, they feel hungrier. And they do fMRI analysis of their brains, and they notice they're a little bit more obsessive with food. So when they show them images of food compared to normal weight or even obese people who have not lost weight, they react more, so their excitatory centers in their brains, they turn on brighter. And at the same time, their inhibitory centers actually are diminished. So they're overall hungrier with less ability to control themselves. And it's all due to leptin, because when they replenish leptin, some of that effect goes away when they give them injections of it. And their metabolism is lower too. And they find that after they've lost, you know, say 10% of their weight, they have to eat 22% fewer calories than someone who's naturally at that weight to begin with. So if someone's 150 and they've never lost weight, they've just naturally been at 150, you know, that's and they compare it to someone who was at 170 but lost 20 pounds to get to 150, the person who's lost the weight has to eat about 22% fewer calories to stay at that weight than someone who didn't diet. And that actually, that effect lasts for years. It's been studied for up to 6 years, and they've seen that it persists, and they're not sure it goes away for everybody. So it's kind of a caloric penalty you have when you lose weight. And it doesn't matter really how you lose it, because they've seen people get liposuction. They have the same effect. Their resting metabolism goes down. And so they have to exercise more. They had this one study where they separated people who got liposuction from their buttocks and their abdomen, and they
they had one group exercise 3 times a week after that, and one group just go back to their normal life. And the group that went to their normal life, they gained the fat back, but not where it was taken from. It came to a new area. It went to their visceral area instead. So the fat came back, but it came back in a less healthy area. The people who exercised didn't. They may manage to keep the weight off. And so it really, no matter how you lose your fat, it's trying to come back. And the way you have to counter that is you have to fight a little bit harder. So if you've yo-yo dieted in the past, you know, you're not imagining it. You really do have to eat less from now on. Your weight really will come back within a year, and that's been studied in a number of different scenarios. And so there's a bit of a penalty, and it's just something we have to live with. And again, many people find that depressing. I found it really empowering because I could now understand why. You know, it's not that all these trainers or other people are right and I'm wrong. It's, you know, I get it now. I do have to eat less than most people to keep weight off.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, it just seems to be unfair. It doesn't seem to be fair. You do all this work and you think, boy, I'm going to boost my metabolism by working hard, but the body is just, ugh. Stubborn.
Your body likes its fat. We don't value fat, but our body really does. And, you know, it does have pathways to come. And another thing that fat can do, interestingly, is it can divert blood supply to itself. Mm-hmm. So it's been known about in tumors, you know, in cancers for a long time, that cancers can actually divert veins to grow in its direction and start forming its own blood supply. In fact, there's, you know, multi-billion dollar drugs now, like Avastin and Sutent, that go out and they stop this from happening. They're anti-angiogenics and it reduces the tumor. Fat can do the same thing. So when we get, you know, more fat, again, it sends out a signal that it needs oxygen, it needs, you know, nutrition, and it'll send out these different type of growth factors that will cause veins to grow in its direction. And so it's, you know, through angiogenesis, it'll develop a new blood supply. And that becomes another pathway then to deposit calories into fat. So you have all this vasculature and all this tissue, you know, so when you're losing fat, you're remodeling your body in a way. And you can imagine that's not very easy to do. There's a lot of things that have to happen. Some of these veins will have to be pruned away. You're losing this tissue. And, you know, so you have this fat in you that, you know, once they're, you know, sorely, like a tumor, it kind of wants to stay. It doesn't really want to go. And then your body also doesn't really want to lose the fat. So through the leptin deprivation, it'll make you hungrier and a lower metabolism. So you just have to understand it. I don't find it to be, you know, too bad now. I think, you know, people do. I think when I first heard about it, I was like, oh, darn. You know, all that those Christmas cookies, I'll never be able to undo it ever. But, you know, you just... you know, you get into, I guess once you accept that, you know, that this is the way it is, you can decide how fat you want to be. And again, you can be fit but fat, and you can come to that acceptance that, well, that's going to be too hard, and I don't want to do that. But I do want to be healthy, so I do want to get rid of visceral fat, but I'm going to accept a certain amount of fat. It's not all bad. And then you can just target, you know, where do you want to be? And depending on where that is, you might never get back to how you were in your 20s, and it might not be realistic. So I think also having a realistic goal about where you want to be on the fatness spectrum, if you will, that will help. And then wherever that is, you'll have to do the appropriate amount of work, which is probably more than most people think to get to that goal.
Hmm. How do you hope readers would use your research?
Yeah. So I think I'm hoping it helps people tweak whatever diet. First, picking the right diet, right? So I think you have to understand who's written the book that you're following. You know, is it, if you're a 50-year-old female, was this written by some 30-year-old trainer, you know, who was Mr. California at one time or something and has a very different body type than you? Because that will factor in how well this will work for you. Diets have to work for you biologically, so they have to work with wherever you are, you know, physiologically. But they also have to work for you psychologically. I mean, can you stay on a diet like this? There's certain foods that I think some people really have to have in order to stay on a diet long term. And does it work for you socially? Can your lifestyle fit this? There are some diets where it's 5 to 7 small meals, 2 hours of exercise a day. And I can tell you, I'll never stay on that diet for very long. I just don't have the time and wherewithal for that. So a diet's not just a 6-month endeavor where you're going to lose this weight and you're going to pop back, right? We know now it's years. It's at least 6 years, and it might be even longer where you kind of have to maintain. Maintenance is as hard as losing it to begin with. And so pick a diet, really, that works for you biologically, that works for you, you know, psychologically and socially, something you can stay on for a really long time. So hopefully this book helps you pick it. Also, I'm hoping it helps people discern why something might not be working that well. So, you know, lots of books written on insulin, and that's great, but there's other things too. Growth hormone is something that you can manage with food and exercise. You know, there's the microbiome that we have, and depending on what set of bacteria you have in your gut, you might be getting more or fewer calories out of your food. So eating for your microbiome is another thing you can do. You know, exercise is something also for promoting adiponectin and growth hormone. So really, there's a lot in the book. It's hard to summarize it really in a conversation because it just spans so much. But it's about tweaking a diet and just being smarter, more strategic about diet and exercise. There's not really a magic bullet yet, right? So there's things, you know, for right now, there's gastric bypass surgery, there's liposuction, there's diet pills, there's hormone replacement therapy. And I know people who do that and they quite like it. I mean, it has risk associated with it, but it works. Or there's diet and exercise. And the ones that you can do right away without, you know, a lot of help is probably diet and exercise, which is why I focus on that in the book, because it's the here and now. Now, in the future, there's other things, too. There's possibly leptin replacement. So, you know, dieters who've lost, you know, that 10% of weight and their leptin is low, they have experimented with injecting leptin back in, and they become less obsessive about food, they're not as hungry, and their metabolism's higher. But it's not available yet and probably really won't be for the next decade or so. It's, you know, very, very early stages of research. You know, brown fat might be interesting someday, or cold exposure, some ways that we do that, but a lot of these things just aren't here yet. And so, you know, I think if you want something immediate that you can do from home, it kind of gets down to diet and exercise, and it also gets down to training your brain as well. And I do write a chapter, you know, on the self-control muscle. Another interesting thing in dieters when they do fMRI analysis of the brains is that people who've successfully lost 30 pounds and kept it off for 3 years or more, they have a whole lemon lollipop in their mouth, and then they look at what's going on in their brains, and they find that, you know, they're excited about it, just like people who've lost weight would be. They're more excited by food. But additionally, their self-control centers light up just as brightly. And so these are people who've learned how to override that, you know, that desire to eat. They have control over the organ, the brain organ. People who are normal weight or obese, their self-control centers don't light up as much. They're not as excited by food, but they also don't have that self-control, you know, bulb that goes off as well. So really successful dieters, they've learned how to stay in control. When they see food, they see it, but their control self-control centers lights up right away as well. And so that's a really important muscle to build up over the years, because any diet plan, even if, you know, we're say eat cake 3 times a day and that's your big luxury diet, there'd be days you don't want to do that. There'd be days you want, you know, pudding or something else. And so... Yeah, so even something that seems like a great diet, you actually still need some willpower to stay on it. And so there's ways to build up that muscle, and this is the third dimension of being successful on a diet, and I do have a chapter on that. And you can start small. I mean, they've seen that people who either control swearing for 2 weeks or they kind of straighten their posture for 2 weeks, they're actually more successful at handling physical discomfort after this 2-week period. They can handle stress better. So something completely unrelated to food. It's just they're learning control in a way. You know, another study where they pay people to go to the gym, and they pay one group to go to the gym once a month, another group to go to the gym 8 times a month. The group that's paid to go 8 times a month, when they stop paying anybody, that group will just start going to the gym. Right, so you have to like kind of see your brain as part of this, as another kind of aid in all of this, and you can build it up slowly, and you do have to give it a rest. So very much like a muscle, if you overuse it, you kind of sabotage yourself. And in another study, they hold a hand exerciser for an hour and a half, and then they split the group into two. One goes and watches a happy movie, the other group will go and watch a sad movie. And when they come back, the group that's watched the sad movie has no energy to hold this hand exerciser anymore. But the group that's watched the happy, they're at it again, right? So you have to actually engineer in breaks into a long regimen if you're on it, if you want to stay on for the long run.
So it sounds like, too, that in addition to kind of prioritizing, okay, what's important to you, what's realistic, it's also a lifestyle,
yeah.
Considering... You know, how does this fit with your lifestyle?
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned your personal struggle with fat. What did you do? How did you do it?
I'm afraid to talk about this, even though I wrote a chapter in a book, because it usually just really is off-putting to people. But I'll tell you what I did anyway. I have very stubborn fat. And I told you my story up front. It's just, you know, since a child, I would just get fat. And, you know, after all the research I did, I could understand why. At least I had a hypothesis of why. I mean, one is I think genetics played in for me.
Okay.
You know, my mother was very much like this. I used to watch her cook for us and then not eat dinner, and I felt so sorry for her. And then little did I know I was going to end up like this later in life. You know, I talked about the thrifty genotype. So there's a group of people, I give the illustration of the Pima Indians who, you know, they survived a number of famines through the centuries that they were there, and they evolved a thrifty genotype where they have a set of genes that helps them be very efficient with food. And they actually are very good fat stores, and so that this thrifty genotype helped them survive all this famine. But now that they're in the time of plenty, you know, and there's a group of them in Phoenix, Arizona that have been studied, they get more obese than Caucasians in the same area, right? So just their genotype they have actually helps them store fat. And this is true of other populations, too. There's a population in Nauru where they're finding the same thing. So depending on what you're from, the lineage, you might be better or worse fat store. And, you know, I'm Eastern Indian, and there's been a number of famines in India as well. So,
scarcity,
you know, it wouldn't surprise me if I had the same kind of thrifty genotype that they talk about, you know, with the Indians. My two X chromosomes don't help me either. So, you know, being a woman, I certainly pack on, you know, more fat than my husband ever will. And so all of those things combined. My yo-yo dieting, I've gone up and down. So certainly I have that caloric penalty I deal with. Mm. But, you know, taking all that, I guess it just helped me understand that this is going to be hard. And that, you know, all these different diets I've been on, designed by people who aren't like me, they're either they're male or they're young or they've never had kids or they've never been heavy, you know, no wonder they're not working. They don't really understand what I'm up against. And so I just started being very attentive to what am I eating, how am I exercising, and every day noticing how it was affecting the scale. And so I had this spreadsheet. I'm a scientist, you know, so I'm very data-driven. I just had this every day. What did I eat? What time did I eat? How many calories was that? When did I exercise? And did my scale move the next day or not? And I finally came to, you know, what was really working or not working. And something surprisingly I can eat, and there's no effect. I can eat small amounts of chocolate. It does nothing to me. I'll still lose weight. I can have a piece of white bread. It's like a piece of cake. You know, I cannot eat white bread. It'll make me gain weight. And there's actually some research now coming out of Israel where they're studying this. They're looking at blood sugar levels of people after they've eaten something. And they find some people can eat chocolate or ice cream and not get a blood sugar spike, and other people can't, you know. So again, we're very individual. But what it got down to for me is as a time I ate seemed to matter. So if I ate later at night, I gained weight. There'd be a pound on the scale the next day. And if I stopped eating earlier in the day, it would burn it off. And so I started doing intermittent fasting, which is I don't eat for about 16 hours. So I stop eating around 3 o'clock or so, and I won't eat again really till 9 o'clock the next day. I found it burns right through really stubborn fat. Mm-hmm. And you know, as far as exercise, I added that in, and it's good to add that in slowly because it does spike your ghrelin levels like we talked about, the hunger hormone. And so if you exercise too much too fast, you'll overcompensate. So I added that in slowly. But then I discovered, you know, things that helped me, I think, release testosterone, growth hormone. High-intensity interval training was really good. So that's when you go, you know, very powerfully, you know, very strongly, you exercise for 20 seconds, you know, rest for about 10 seconds and do that for about 8 cycles. And amazingly enough, it also burned off fat. So, you know, I do eat probably less than, first of all, most people don't have to do what I do. So I just want to make that clear that this is not the solution for everyone. This was it for me. I mean, I'm petite and I have the issues we talked about. But mostly it's intermittent fasting, and I added, you know, HIIT onto it, and that seems to keep weight off. And, you know, I lost 30 pounds ultimately, and it's been off for years now. And actually my editor, when I handed in my manuscript, he also lost 15 pounds just from reading all the stuff about fat and understanding his fat. And he's also kept the weight off, so hopefully, you know, just from reading, you can lose 15 pounds.
Well, so because I'm curious, I mean, there have been articles written about fasting in general, how it's a good thing that there are some positive benefits and that it kind of gives the system a rest. But in your case with intermittent fasting, what's the idea behind that?
Yeah, so growth hormone peaks at night, right? And that's a great, great fat burner. It's something that declines with age. And so when you eat, actually, it starts to mitigate growth hormone. Also, there's that hormone ghrelin, the hunger hormone. It's actually an agonist for ghrelin. So if you can stand it, if you're hungry, it actually promotes the release of growth hormone, which then burns fat. So the longer you can keep this, you know, overnight peak going, you know, it actually will start to burn some more fat for you. And it's not easy to do, I'll admit, but I did get used to it in the end. Like I'm not that hungry at night anymore. In fact, when I eat, it feels odd. I almost feel too full. So as hard as something might seem to go on, you actually can do it. You'd be surprised actually at how much you can do. And I feel comfortable now. You know, I can feel as I start going into fasting hours, I feel kind of calm and, you know, and all that. And of course, after Christmas, I've not been fasting as much as I used to. But, you know, but overall, you can endure. You can get used to these things that seem like they're, you know, you'll never be able to do it. And so I just tell people, like, you know, don't despair. If you really want to lose weight, it might be harder than you think, but you can absolutely do it. And you probably don't have to do anything as extreme as I did. I just have very stubborn fat. But whatever it is, you know, you can restrict that 22% fewer calories you might have to eat from now on. Entirely possible, right, to get. And the other thing to think about is really the microbiome. That's another thing I learned is that, you know, depending on the bacteria you have, you could be getting more or less calories from your food, right? Bacteria, they have enzymes we don't. They actually help us digest foods, and they turn them into simple sugars. So the other thing I started doing was just eating a lot of really fibrous foods, a lot of kind of prebiotic foods. And so when I do eat, you know, lunch, my main meal, it's usually a pretty big salad that will fill me up. And I notice also pounds will leave me pretty quickly when I'm on that. So I'd say just be really attentive, keep a log. And that's actually one of the qualities of successful dieters. They log their food all the time, and they log their activity. And they rarely go off their diets. They're usually on, or they snap back on quickly. And just start to monitor for yourself, you know, just like that study from Israel. What is it that's affecting you? And you'll start to see things that you can eat and get away with, other things that you can't eat, and you can modulate. I kind of invented my own diet in a way. And, you know, I think people can too, or you can at least modulate the one you're on to try to make it work for you if it's not.
Because, like, Mark Bittman did his, what is it, vegan before six? Is that right? So, and then in your case, you stop eating at a certain time, right? So, like, early afternoon.
Yeah, 3:30.
Okay, so that's...
But I know people have done it differently, too. They'll eat at night, and then they won't eat again, really, until, you know, 4 o'clock or whatever, 3 o'clock or something the next day. So there's different ways to do that,
Okay, but what about when you're traveling, like, now?
I'll gain 3 pounds from this trip, pretty much,
Are you able to stick? Is it harder to...
It's certainly harder, right? Especially if you're changing time zones and all of that. So, like, I'm not... I come off as I need to. I think if you're about 80% adherent to your diet, it can do you some good. If you start being 50% adherent, you're not going to get the benefit. You'll do a lot of work 50% of the time and not reap the reward. But, you know, I eat Christmas cookies like everyone else. There's no way I'm getting through Christmas without indulging here or there. And the key is just to get back on. So there's, you know, another quality, which is dichotomous thinking, which is what people have to be careful of. And this is where, and this is particularly prevalent in women, but men have it too, where if you make one mistake, you feel like there's no use in trying again. And so it's like kind of psychology. If I didn't get an A, it's an F. Like nothing else matters except an A. Anything else is an F. And people do this with dieting quite a bit. Like if they messed up on a day, like, well, what's the point? I might as well have a beer tomorrow too, or another cookie tomorrow. You know, they'll go down this slippery slope. And you know, people who do this are not only prone to regain weight; they're more prone to depression. They're more prone to feeling out of control. And so it's another one that, you know, it's fine. I go off, you know, here and there. I travel. I have kids. Sometimes I go out with them. But just get back on and try to be 80% at least adherent to a diet. And it's what some of the obesity experts I interviewed, you know, also said, that, you know, people go off all the time. The key is really to get back on as quickly as you can.
So now that you've found a way to control it, to deal with your stubborn fat, how would you describe your relationship with fat?
I love my fat. I appreciate my fat. Like, I realize all these years I've been yo-yo dieting, and, you know, my teenage years where I did starvation. I'm like, I've been mean to it, actually. Like, it's been there trying to help me. It's been producing leptin. It's been producing estrogen. It's been producing adiponectin. And all this while, like, I just really never knew. And so I think we have a balanced relationship where we appreciate each other a little bit, but we're also aware of the power the other one has. So I'm aware of the power my fat has. I know it's ready to come back if I slip up too many times. But I think just through, you know, the strength and power I've put into losing it, it must also be aware that, you know, I'm another force to be reckoned with as well. So, you know, it's a comfortable, more balance. And for me, some of this was more about getting back into control of my fat. I mean, as we age, I gained weight as I started a career. You know, I had a kid gain 10 pounds, another kid gain another 10 pounds, and everyone splurges on something. My thing to splurge on was these beautiful, beautiful dresses that were hanging in my closet. and I couldn't wear them anymore. And they weren't cheap dresses. And, you know, I finally got to a point where, you know, I'm approaching 50, and I might never wear those dresses again. And, you know, so it was, you know, do I want this life? That is controlling me now. It's controlling my life. And, you know, just a matter of being tired of it. Like, I will have control. How dare something invade me and have this control? So that kind of gave me the determination to, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I'm going to understand it. And so I think, you know, now I appreciate it. I don't need to be as thin as I was in my 20s. I don't feel that at all, you know, because fat is important, and I've learned that. You know, at the same time, I realize how hard it is to really keep in control, how much work I have to do every day. And so it's a comfortable balance now. It's a more respectful relationship between the two of us. Yeah.
A détente.
Yeah.
All right. Well, no, I've learned a lot too about fat, the how wily it is, and how useful it can be.
Yeah.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum, featuring Ruby DeLuna's conversation with author Sylvia Tara at Town Hall Seattle on January 9th. Tara's new book is The Secret Life of Fat, the science behind the body's least understood organ and what it means for you. Thank you again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.